Thanks, everybody, for coming. I'm Charles Freeman. I am the Freeman Chair in China Studies, no relation. The Freeman Foundation was kind enough to endow this chair some 15 years ago before I was a twinkle in their eye. This session is to bring to your attention a new report that we were coming out with, that we've just come out with, called Assessing the Chinese Government's Response to the Challenge of Environment and Health. And it's a topic that's clearly on a lot of folks' mind, not just with the Olympics coming up, but with the rise in our own awareness and understanding of the challenge of climate change, the challenge of the environment, and the rest. I'm used to spending time talking about China in terms of superlatives. I spend a lot of time looking at Chinese economic growth, so I frequently get to talk about China in terms of 10% annual rise and this or that as being something very positive. In this case, not so much. If you look at China over the past 30 years and you look at the dramatic increases in Chinese economic growth, there has been some challenges as well. Soil pollution, about 10 million hectares of land, about 10% of China's arable land is polluted with heavy metals. That contributes to about 12 million tons of polluted grain per year. China has passed the United States as the number one emitter of greenhouse gases on the planet. Sulfur dioxide, China annually emits some 25 million tons of sulfur dioxide, the primary cause or a primary contributor to acid rain on the planet, although in the last 2 years there is some good news in China's decrease in emissions there. And water. 40% of China's water is unfit for human consumption or for use in agriculture and or industrial performance. 90% of China's groundwater in the cities is polluted, and 75%, by some estimation, of China's rivers and lakes are polluted. Between at least 320 and some say 350 million people in China lack access to clean drinking water. And this is all before we get into the question of what happens with climate change. So by my recognition, if we look at soil, air and water, three out of the four Aristotelian elements are covered, earth, wind, and water, China's in deep trouble. The health impacts is what we're looking at today of the environmental challenge, and it's frankly an area that doesn't receive perhaps as much focus as it should, it's the area that ultimately it's why we're concerned about the environmental challenge. Just looking at death rates in China, cancer death rates are up 80% in 30 years. Last year, there were 136 out of 100,000 deaths attributed to cancer. It's the number one killer in cities. It's the second killer in the countryside, although it will, by most estimates, it will surpass the cerebrovascular problems as the number one killer soon. Yes, you can attribute some of that to increases in China's age, and the people are living longer, and so they're dying of cancer. Yes, you can attribute some of that to the fact that people are reporting cancer when in the past they might have been reporting deaths due to old age. Yes, you can attribute some of that to smoking, but even taking lung cancer, 465 increase in lung cancer deaths in 30 years. Adjusting that for age, that's still 261% in 30 years. And smoking has come down in 15 years by about 15%. So something else is clearly going on here with respect to air pollution. Water pollution is contributing anecdotally to significant liver and stomach cancer, particularly in the countryside. And this starts with Hep B, moves into cancer. There are significant challenges here. I wish I had a more upbeat message today. I feel like I'm having a bit of an Al Gore moment, unfortunately. But this is something I think which, while it is probably very sensitive to the Chinese government to talk about the connection between health and environmental issues, indeed, the Chinese government at one point asked the World Bank to remove references to the health problems resulting from the environment in one of their reports. It's something that I think we all need to be focused on, because the health problems of the environment are not confined to China, and even if they were, it's something that we all should be concerned about. I'm going to introduce two of our panelists today who know vastly more than I do about this subject. The first is Liu Xiaoqing, who is the brains and the brawn behind the report itself, with me playing a very supporting role, I'm happy to say. And Xiaoqing is a research associate in the Freeman Chair, and her bio is available for all to see. Trevor Hauser is a partner in the Rhodium Group, and as you'll hear later, is one of the smartest people on the planet, as far as I'm concerned, on the climate change issue and its and the China factor in particular. And we'll get into this, and hopefully we'll get into some questions. I know that there are a lot of people in this audience that are smarter than we are, I think, on some of these issues, so hopefully we'll hear from them as well. But with that, let me turn it over to Xiaoqing. Thank you.
Thanks, Charles, for the kind introduction. I'd like to discuss three points covered in this report. Number one, what is the connection between environment and health? Number two, why does it matter? Why do we care? And number three, what is the bureaucratic barrier in the government response to this emerging challenge? First of all, the nexus, the connection between environment and health. China, we all know that China is facing enormous environment and pollution problems. However, to date, the cost of pollution has been mostly measured in simple economic terms, mostly by reference to industrial loss or cost of remediation. There has been no systematic efforts to measure the health impact of pollution. This study project attempts to build such a link between pollution and health, as well as to examine the government response. As we try to establish the nexus between environment and health, we realize that this is actually an issue that has not been particularly well understood in the Chinese policy community. As a result, comprehensive and official data on the real impact of pollution on health are largely non-existent in China, and the little knowledge that does exist is primarily anecdotal. There have been a few recent international efforts to assess this specific linkage in China. An OECD report from 2007 indicates that China's severely polluted environment has, quote, caused significant damage to human health, hurting productivity, and driving up healthcare costs, unquote. According to some unreleased World Bank data that Charles just mentioned, 750,000 people die prematurely in China each year from high pollution levels. The challenge of environment and health is widespread and severe in China. The problem has manifested through the worsening air and water pollution and food contamination over the recent years, as Charles just pointed out. Here are some additionally sobering statistics. Only 1% of China's 560 million urban residents are breathing air considered safe by European Union standards. 1%. Two-thirds of China's rural population does not have access to piped water. The lack of piped water contributes to diseases and cancers of the digestive system. The World Bank estimates that this specific cost of this health impact is roughly 1.9% of China's rural GDP in 2007. Also, I'd like to point out that the environmental health risk has a much stronger impact on rural China, where almost 90% of the population does not have medical insurance, and 95% of the rural elderly have no pension. What this means is, although cities like Shanghai and Beijing may have higher level of air pollution than many other rural areas, their health risk ratings are actually lower as a result of better access to health care, as well as better nutrition among the urban population. So now, what are the implications for this emerging challenge? The growing health impact of pollution has considerable domestic and international implications. As China aspires to build a harmonious society based on scientific development and become a responsible global player, environmental health problems present a looming challenge as well as a necessary task for the Chinese government to tackle. Let me address some of the domestic implications. Environment and health are at the top of the Beijing's domestic agenda. Pollution burdens the Chinese economy, drives up healthcare costs. The leadership is very concerned as they know that the deteriorating environment implies a heavy burden of disease and a rising cost of treatment for the government and for the Chinese public. More importantly, Beijing has begun to be very sensitized to the potential impact of environmental health conditions on social stability. Over the recent years, we've noticed a spike in the reported number of riots, demonstrations, petitions nationwide on the public anger at the pollution and its health effects. This raises the possibility that environmental health is becoming a matter on which the leadership's political legitimacy might rest, at least partially. That said, however, the challenge of environmental health is not just China's internal problem. The global implications of this challenge have already drawn much international attention. In today's globalizing world, we all know that environment and health threats travel across national boundaries. We've seen China's dust storms hit the Korean Peninsula every spring. We've also seen the 2005 benzene spill in Songhua River, which eventually affected parts of the water supply in Russia. Another matter that raised political attention, particularly in the United States, is the tainted Chinese food and drug exports that have severe health risks. The food safety issue results from a range of issues, such as land and water contamination in China, as Charles pointed out earlier, overuse of pesticides, and the loosely administered Chinese environmental standards across the country. Recent recalls of tainted Chinese products have served a wake-up call for Beijing. China is now in the midst of a significant reevaluation of its pollute first and clean up later strategy in order to better reflect the need to balance its people and nature. The connection between environment and health needs to be highlighted and addressed as Beijing readjusts its development strategy. Lastly, I want to talk about one particular barrier within the Chinese government to forming an effective response to this emerging challenge. In China, while SIPA and Ministry of Health bear the main responsibility for environmental health problems, many, many other government agencies are actually involved. As a matter of fact, there are over 18 agencies at the central level sharing the responsibility one way or the other. We actually have a list of all relevant agencies listed in the appendix of this report. Due to bureaucratic stovepiping and unclear bureaucratic lines of authority, officials from all relevant bureaucracies rarely work together. I do want to point out that the challenge of collaborating with different bureaucracy is not unique to China. The World Bank has actually described environmental health as a problem which is an institutional orphan. However, in China, the turf battles seem to be exaggerated by the many agencies involved in this process. In addition, until very recently, SIPA has been very weak, and it's a very understaffed agency with a small budget. Its low political standing over the past years means it did not have the institutional power to lead and coordinate the government response with its bureaucratic rivals. As a result, many of China's environmental health problems remain unaddressed. The lack of a supra-ministerial entity with a core mandate for environment and health means China needs an interagency strategy. The good news is Beijing has recently announced its first national environmental health action plan for the next 5 years. The action plan, signed by all 18 agencies that I just mentioned, calls for an enhanced interagency coordination led by the environment and health ministries. However, while the action plan reflects Beijing's new commitment to stepping up its interagency efforts, it still faces significant implementation challenges on the ground. Lastly, before I stop, I want to discuss very briefly the new environmental ministry. The elevation of SEPA to a full ministerial status represents Beijing's strengthened commitment to solving some of its environmental problems. With a new environmental ministry in place, one would expect a more powerful environmental leadership to drive policies at the central level. However, the new ministry still needs to overcome challenges to ensure other agencies outside the environment and health system have enough incentive to take on extra work and expense. Also, as the power to appoint local environmental officials still rests with the local authority, Beijing still needs to figure out ways to manage the challenge of translating its environmental agenda, which is very good, into real action at the local levels. I will stop here and turn it over to Charles, who will cover some other points in this report. Thank you.
Thanks, and very, very few other points. Because we'll get on to the real wisdom here. I was remiss in not thanking the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, who was who made this all possible, and we do want to thank their contribution. The good news, as Xiaoqing said, suggests, is that the Chinese government is clearly seized with the issue and recognizes they have an environmental issue. Hu Jintao, in focusing at the in late 2007 in October on the need for China to become a conservation culture, focusing on the new environmental regulations, which require much more onerous environmental regulation at the local level of industrial projects in particular. And an insistence that care for the environment is a factor in job promotions and in job reviews for local officials. These are all very, very important. But if what Beijing wanted was automatically that automatically translated into in what happened in China, a lot of things would be different. As we all know, China has a serious governance problem. And one of the huge benefits of decentralization has been economic growth over the past 30 years, but the huge problems has been a lack of control or a cession of control over what went on at the local level by the national level. So you can say, yes, it's good that Beijing has got the message that it's important to do something about environmental issues. And you can be cynical and suggest, oh, well, this is purely in response to protests and that this is just a desire to look good in the face of and maintain legitimacy. But that's good governance, folks. And at the end of the day, that's what it's all about, is to try to fix the problem. In practice, it's not as easy as they would like. Asking the local officials to take on environmental challenges as part of their overall portfolio is very, very difficult. Local officials are asked, after all, to do a number of things, and job one remains economic growth. The key mantra of the Chinese government in Beijing is they still need to produce 50,000 new jobs a day and deliver on the order of 7.5% to 10% growth in order to maintain their popular legitimacy in their view, and that's pretty tough to do and crack down on the environment at the same time. So saying to the local officials, right, okay, job one is growth, but job 1.1 is taking care of the environment is very, very tough. And when you add to that fact that local officials are also required to take care of health care in large measure for local populations, you've got a big burden on local officials. Decentralization has been coupled in recent years by a recentralization in part of taxation. So at the same time as these burdens have been shifted to the local communities for growth, for health care, and now for environment and other things, a lot of the money is being siphoned away by the center. So asking the local officials to deal with all this, even before you get into other questions, is a significant burden. That said, so if you're a local official and you're faced with a choice of how do I manage all this? I mean, how do I do all this? Your first inclination is going to be to generate revenue. The best way of generating revenue is to to make sure that you have industries that generate jobs, that create revenues, and so you're going to protect local industries first. Local industries are going to shop around for jurisdictions that in which they can get the best deal at the lowest cost. That tends to be they tend to shop for jurisdictions that are most friendly to environmental regulations, and so you do have a bit of a race to the bottom in some respects. This is even before you get into the question of red envelopes that go around that contain cash to local officials, which is of course a separate problem. What do you do about it? What does Beijing do about all that? It's a major issue, and some foreign attention to this, to the nexus between health and the environment would be very useful. The Olympics should be a wonderful opportunity for the international community to say there is a nexus between environment and health. And yes, there's been a lot of attention to the environment and to the challenges of Beijing's environment as in the connection of the Olympics. A lot of that attention, though, paradoxically, has been on the health care associated with the athletes and not the people who have to live there every day. So, and I feel tremendous sympathy for marathoners who have to run in Beijing's air, but that I feel much more sympathy to the 300 million residents in China who don't have access, or 320 who don't have access to clean water, and I think that the Olympics and what Beijing is trying to do, generally in trying to stimulate interest and trying to stimulate environmental awareness, could really use a boost from the international community as opposed to a lot of the finger-pointing and the rest of it that they're getting. So I am perhaps less sensitive to the criticism that Beijing is receiving is in the context of the Olympics for the environment. I think the environment and the international community could do a lot by getting together with Beijing and recognizing that Beijing needs a little help. That said, I don't either want to excuse Beijing because it lacks the governance, it lacks the ability to govern at the local level, or because they're not getting the help they need. There is a lot that as Xiaoqing mentioned, that needs to go on, not the least of which is institutional reform. The government is on the right track by elevating the environmental authorities to a full ministry, but again, as Xiaoqing was suggesting, the stovepiping in China makes our bureaucracy look tame. There are furious turf battles, and frankly, it's almost impossible to get anything done without a superministerial authority and without someone at the top saying, "Okay, we may have problems at the local level. We need to deal with ourselves at the top," and that really is job one. And that, despite efforts to turn China into a conservation culture, has not happened in the spring. There was the elevation, but something stopped. And there wasn't enough recognition of that the stovepiping and the interministerial squabbles need to stop, and that someone actually needs to get together and say, okay, there are nexuses that need to be achieved here, and we need to take care of the broad issue and not just take care of the narrow interests of individual ministries. That has to change. Hopefully, with some international attention would help there, and I'm hoping that the media and others will bring some attention to that. Accountability. The governance problem is not an excuse. The local authorities need to really be held accountable for actions. That means that Beijing needs to not only make environment part of a job review concern, but also to provide local authorities real incentives, genuine incentives to take care of problems. If you look anecdotally at what's happened at the local level with the environmental mandates, for example, for water treatment, there have been many water treatment facilities that have been built in the process of the last 2 years. Very few have been turned on because it's one thing to build them, it's another thing to actually pay for them, to actually operate them. So there are things that need to happen to make this system work, and it's not just about writing the laws and hoping that they'll operate. You actually have to create genuine incentives and genuine funding to make these things work. civil society. China and Beijing in particular has a problem with civil society. We know this. Beijing has a problem with non-government organizations, and they're concerned about them. NGOs are Beijing's best friend in this process. NGOs truly can help Beijing in particular deal with its center local problem, because NGOs actually can, if NGOs can not only help Beijing because they can work with local local citizens on to bring environmental problems to light, Beijing can also empower those NGOs to operate when there is a conflict between local officials and national officials. Beijing should be recognizing that, you know, the time has passed when it's when these folks are the enemies of Beijing's long-term interests. They're actually, as Beijing has discovered in recent months with the media, and particularly in the earthquake context, there are times when civil society organizations really can be harnessed to assist with national goals. This is one of those times. And finally, U.S.-China cooperation. Give a big shout out and a big ups to Hank Paulson for efforts during the SED to put environmental issues on the front burner of U.S.-China cooperation. That's critical. It's time to take it to the next step and make sure that U.S.-China cooperation on the health-related aspects of the environment are front and center, because it's focusing on long-term climate change issues is very important. There are near-term issues that really need some attention. The U.S. and China work well together on some healthcare issues related to HIV/AIDS and TB and other infectious disease. We work reasonably well on some aspects of environment, but it's time to put a bridge between the two and work together well in ways that are not, quote, sensitive to the Chinese authorities, because they have the potential to create unrest. Yes, China does have sensitivities because of the social stability aspects of local environmental protests, but this is an area where the United States and China can really be cooperative, and I do hope that even if it's not during the duration of this administration, that the next administration can take it to the next level. I'll turn it over to Trevor.
Thanks very much, Charles, for an introduction that I can only now fail to live up to expectations on. It's a pleasure to be here. My compliments to both the authors on a fantastic paper, and they did such a good job of laying out the nature of the challenge that I don't really have anything to add there. So I thought what I would do is turn to a couple issues in thinking about how China, with international partners, moves forward on this, and to challenge the authors to think about what some of the caveats there might be. And I'm going to break them down into three sets of relationships that I think are going to be important. And it's center-local relations, inter-provincial relations, and state-society relations. On the center-local relations, and this is something that the authors spend quite a bit of time on, rightly so, and that Charles mentioned, there's a tension between national-level enlightenment and policy directives and local-level implementation. This has been a problem not just on environmental issues but on other issues, and it's a problem that's not new to China. It's existed for a long time, and if you look at the structure of the way local and provincial officials are assigned, it's created to prevent this type of thing from happening. You don't serve in a province that you grew up in. You're rotated around. You're not elected. I mean, the whole system is designed to make sure that you listen to Beijing, not to the local provinces, yet that's not what's happening. So the question is why, and I think that Charles raised some of those important points about where are you getting funding from? What are the metrics on which you're scored? But I think there's a question out there is if Beijing really does get enlightened, if this becomes a top priority, if the number of environmental protests increase to the point where it's threatening social stability, and this becomes priority number one, not priority number two, is that sufficient? Is that sufficient to get action at a provincial level? If your job performance is going to be determined primarily on environmental metrics, will that be enough? And I think there's a couple reasons why it won't be. The first is that at this point in time, the ability to monitor and verify compliance is very thin. And it's short of something like a benzene slick in the Songhua River, which is very visible and which you will certainly get fired over. Right now, you will certainly get fired over. What we're talking about here is smaller than that. It's pollution that has a long-term health effect, not a near-term health effect. The cancer village doesn't show up for a decade, right? By that time, as a provincial official, you're a couple jobs down the road. This is not foreign to us here in the U.S. thinking about environmental policy. Why take on cost today as an official with a, you know, with a four-year term if the benefits aren't going to be seen until a couple guys after you in office? So I think the question is the solution stronger control from the state to the provincial level, right? Or is the solution increasing the accountability, counter to the way that this has been structured historically, increasing the accountability of local officials to the people that are actually getting the cancer or dealing with the environmental effects? I'm not a political scientist, so I'm going to throw that open to the political scientist to answer. But I think we look at, in the debate about this, we look at how can Beijing, you know, exert a stronger grasp on provinces, right? And I don't know that at the end of the day that's going to be the necessary answer. On interprovincial tensions, for Japan and Korea and Taiwan, they all reached a point of development where your basic bread and butter needs are taken care of, and you start being interested in luxury goods like not getting asthma and not getting cancer, right? Once you have, which is a luxury good to a certain extent, maybe not the cancer, but the asthma definitely. There's a difference between the experience of South Korea, Japan, and Taiwan, and the experience of China. And that in South Korea, Japan, and Taiwan, the whole country got to that point at relatively the same period of time, right? So you had an emerging middle class, 7,000, 8,000 per capita GDP, who was willing to pay and had the ability to pay for a cleaner environment. I think that there's a challenge unique to China, and I don't see how Beijing manages this, and this is my kind of second challenge to the authors, is that Beijing and Shanghai and Guangzhou and Fujian are at that level today pretty much, between 4,000 and 7,000 per capita GDP. And indeed, they're at a place where they have both the willingness and the ability to pay for cleaner air and water. And the problem is that the air in Beijing is only partly determined by what happens in Beijing. It's much more determined by what happens in Shanxi and what blows to Beijing. The water in Shanghai is partly determined by what you do in Shanghai, but it's largely determined by what you do upriver. And then there's, of course, all the international effects that Charles mentioned. So it is clearly an issue, environment is, where it's Beijing's mandate to solve, right? Corruption, I think, in contrast, is a fairly easy issue to deal with if you're sitting in Beijing. There's a long history of provincial and local residents under the tutelage of despotic warlords appealing to Beijing, right, to come in and save them from the local despots. And today you see that play out in corruption dynamics, that Beijing comes in and has an anti-corruption campaign, and the national government ends up looking pretty good and the local government ends up looking pretty bad. With environment, there's a component of this, an interprovincial component, which is necessarily a national priority to solve and is only the job of the national government. And there, I think, Beijing has a legitimacy challenge if they can't rise to the challenge. And I don't know. I mean, we have a problem with this in the U.S. Just witness the D.C. appellate court's ruling on the clean air interstate rule, right? And how do you deal with emissions and pollution that start in one state and move to another state? This is a contentious issue in rule of law democracies. I assume it's going to be a much more contentious issue in China. A good example of this would be the experience with green GDP. China sought to undertake a green GDP accounting as an alternative metric to use to rank provincial and local officials. And they found what the UN had found, that it's very difficult to do green GDP. You can start with the resource accounting, so everything you dig out of the ground is scored against. You're depleting an asset. And then you try to factor in some environmental health effects. And what they found was that if you are a province that sells coal to the rest of the country, like Shanxi, you have negative GDP, right? And not because you're burning more in your province, but because that's your comparative advantage within a Chinese context. And so it's very difficult to have that type of ranking system if you happen to be sitting on the coal. And again, that's going to be an issue where interprovincial adjudication is going to be very important. On society state, I think Charles framed this very well, that there's a concern that environmental NGOs will be a source of instability, but in reality they are probably Beijing's best friend. I'd make a couple caveats to that. once the genie's out of the bottle, it's hard to put it back in, that it's true that they're Beijing's best friend up until the point that Beijing is unable to deal with environment. And then environmental NGOs can showcase the impotence of central government, which is ultimately very, very dangerous. There's this tension with transparency in data, in particular. If you release the data about air quality, you create a lot of eyes, millions of eyes on the problem, putting pressure on local officials. And that was the intention with the clean air data that China's had in place for quite a while. It's constantly monitored. 84 cities throughout China, you can look and see what the air quality is. It's modeled on the U.S. Air Pollution Index or Air Quality Index. The challenge is once you've got that up and you start setting targets, like for blue sky days in Beijing, what do you do when you're not meeting those targets, right? You can't take the data away. Because if you took it away, it's very noticed, right? But if you don't meet the target, you have a governance challenge, right? Is this Chatham House rules?
Go for it.
Okay. If there's any reporters, this next part's off the record. If you look closely at the data, Beijing EPB data, air quality data, over the past couple years, the cutoff line for a blue sky day is a count of 100 out of a scale of 1 to 500. In the U.S., it would be a count of 50, but 100 for Beijing is a pretty good day. I jog on 100 day in Beijing. And the target is 200-something blue sky days, and that's been ramping up to the Olympics. If you look at the distribution, right, of days, there are an unbelievable number of 99 days, right? So many so that it is a statistical impossibility, right? And you look at the number of 99 days versus the number of 101 days, there's not many 101 days, right? It doesn't take a lot to move the needle 2 degrees over the line to meet a target, right? And so there's a risk that in an environment where there's a political mandate to deliver a certain outcome, that you, by introducing transparency in data, which I'm not saying is a bad thing, but there's a risk that you lose public credibility in that data. And over the long term, that becomes a very big challenge if the people don't believe the numbers government's reporting. Because there actually are very important strides being made in environment and air quality. And you would want to report the positive ones and have people would believe them. In the international stage, it's going to be critical that we believe what China says about what it's doing in terms of climate change, greenhouse gas emissions. So that's another thing that I think is challenging. So that's a whole lot of problems that I'm tossing over to you to solve. I think that, you know, we talk about, and I as much as anybody talk about the challenges of environment and energy in China and talk about all the risks of not getting it taken care of. We're all a little bit hesitant to play that through to what's the implication, right? If you have 70,000 mass incidents a year and a significant share of those are about environment, on current trajectories, at what point does the train come off the rails? Does the government have the institutional capability to handle this? I'm optimistic about that. But I think that we don't have a frank discussion about where it's going. It's easy to talk about the challenges today, and we don't have a very frank discussion about, you know, what are the odds of dealing with the problem. I'm optimistic for a couple reasons. I think that we have 3 decades, a very impressive track record of China dealing with massive adjustment problems, including dealing with, you know, center-local relations have been challenges that have had to be dealt with in the past. WTO accession would be a good example of that, right? There's a lot of skull-cracking at the local level that's happened before, and Beijing certainly has the ability to do that again. The second is that we're seeing tangible progress in reducing air pollution. And here I would say air pollution, I think, is actually a far easier challenge to deal with than water pollution. Water, if there's anything that's going to send this train off the rails, it's going to be water, not air. Air pollution, the cost of installing a sulfur scrubber and running it is not that great, right, relative to the economy. I mean, the cost of that sulfur dioxide emission in terms of economic loss is probably $150 billion a year. The cost of installing and running flue gas desulfurization systems on all power plants would be less than $150 billion a year. So there it's not a trade-off between growth and environmental protection. It's just getting the policy right. And initial attempts were you just set a mandate that power plants install flue gas systems. And a lot of them did, and they didn't turn it on, right? There's changes in thinking about, instead of a mandate, give power plants a premium in the price that they can sell to the grid if they run them. And we're starting to see some effects from that. I mean, sulfur dioxide emissions declined last year nationwide at a time when power generation increased by 12%. So that's meaningful. That's a meaningful change. And I think that that's a problem that's not intransigent. Another reason I'm optimistic, up until 2007, SEPA never rejected an industrial plant application. 2007, they rejected a third of them. right, on EIA assessment grounds. Now, I don't know how many of those plants ended up finally getting through approval and how stringent the requirement was, but there's at least a movement towards a more proactive environmental regulator. It has a long way to go, but it's a movement in that direction. For that reason, I'm optimistic. And the final reason is that for China, it's not a binary trade-off between environmental protection and economic growth, right? It is for a lot of countries. At this point in China's development, it's not for China. The industries that are responsible for a majority of China's air pollution, its water pollution, and its energy demand are not big employers and don't contribute as productively to economic growth as other sectors. The five most energy-intensive industries combined account for about 42% of China's energy demand, and just a little under half of China's SO2 and particulate matter pollutions. Yet, those industries employ only 13 million people, which is fewer than the service sector in Guangdong province alone. So if indeed you need to create 15 million new jobs a year, that's not the way to do it. So why have those industries come to the fore? It's because if you need to collect tax revenue and you need to point to direct investment, that's an easy way to do it. I don't want to chase around 1,000 small electronics manufacturers to collect taxes when I can go to one state-owned steel mill, and maybe they don't pay me half of the time, but it's easier to collect from. Those industries are going to have diminishing returns for provinces, both on unemployment and an economic output level, and that's already starting to happen. Steel, aluminum, cement production is becoming less competitive in China and moving to other places, sometimes with Chinese companies. And so I think that while before it's how do you wrestle with at the provincial level this kind of vague mandate that Beijing gave you about environmental protection with, you know, some real needs of job creation and fixed asset investment, I think over time the way that the economics are heading is going to become clear at a local and provincial level that I need to start doing something different. I'm not creating enough jobs with these industries. I need to start looking at investing in service sector. That's a medium-term picture, not a near-term picture. The final point that I would make, and this is this ties into Charles's last point about cooperation, and here I agree with him absolutely. I think that the number one thing, I'm not going to talk about climate change a lot, but in the Q&A, if anybody has questions, I can get into it. I think the number one thing the U.S. can do right now to help China reduce CO2 emissions is not deal with climate change at all, is deal with these very pressing local environmental and energy issues for a couple reasons. One, most of the things you do to deal with those problems will have a climate benefit. Two, if you go to China and you talk about cooperating on climate change, you carry with you this whole baggage of international climate negotiations where China is limited in what it's willing to commit to by its role as a developing country and the way we talk about developing countries in international climate negotiations. It's not the same if you go and talk about energy and environment. Then you can have a partnership between equals, and a lot of that baggage gets cleared out. That's why the Strategic Economic Dialogue doesn't talk about climate change. Well, that, and because it's a Bush administration initiative, but I think there's a real logic why it doesn't, and that you can get far more done dealing directly with sulfur dioxide emission, with energy efficiency, than talking about climate change. The institutions that you're going to need to implement effective climate policy do not exist today in China, but they can be built for particulate matter, sulfur dioxide emission, dealing with those issues, and so there I'm optimistic as well.
Thank you. Those are great comments. And I do want to say on the cooperation side, and you know, this, to the extent this comes down to a conversation about technology transfer or money, I think technologies that help China monitor with monitoring and environmental compliance on a local level would be extremely useful. So we'll throw it open to questions and comments. I mean, there are some people, and I see you back there, who know an awful lot about these things. So I want to encourage all of you to raise questions, comments, please. Right in the back.
Jennifer Turner, director of the China Environment Forum, and I want to thank Trevor. He actually just gave a talk in my shop this morning and gave another one in between and came to you, so applause for him, like the stamina this guy has. I wanted to ask a specific question about the environmental health plan that was recently passed. It's part of a larger UN program, and I was wondering in your conversations with, I don't know, some of the 18 agencies that are involved in it, besides the plan, because Chinese are really good at planning, but I mean, are there some concrete pilot projects that the UN is planning to do, or is this just kind of, I mean, it seems not a very helpful exercise, even though it is encouraging to see someone talking about environmental health, because aside from Rockefeller Brother Fund, there's not really, I mean, we monitor environmental cooperation with China all around the world going there, and there's very few that talk about the health angle. So I was curious if you can tell us a little bit more, or, you know, about what this health action plan is going to do.
My answer is not very optimistic. They just had the plan out. It's a response to the call from WHO and UNEP. The first step is to translate into English, and that's getting done. My conversation with officials in the environment and health ministries is that I don't think they have a concrete plan for the next year for local implementation, although I think the health ministry might have going to get some funding from WHO to do some pilot project in selected provinces, but that's just a plan. I don't think there is any sustained funding in place to make the local implementation happen. That's what I think it's the next big challenge is we have the good plan how we implement it in localities.
Thank you. I'm Susan Lawrence, head of China programs at the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. I wondered actually, and I know that I'm very up close to the issue of tobacco, but I do think that it actually deserves a big, it's a big part of this story about environment and health. Partly because the tobacco is driving a lot of the healthcare problems that we're seeing in China. It's responsible for this kind of explosion of non-communicable disease issues that we're now seeing. And you mentioned lung cancer rates rising 465% and so on. But the movements to do something about the tobacco epidemic very much converge with the movement to do something about China's environmental problems. And in fact, we work very closely with MOH and the Ministry of Environment, and they've very much joined together to work on tobacco, and it's been great seeing them do it. And they've been able to really build coalitions all over the country, actually, bringing together environment people, health people, education people, youth league people, women's federation people, who are all affected by these same issues. And it's the issue, when you're talking about tobacco or generally horrible air pollution and bad water, this is affecting the health, it's affecting public health in a big way. But I see them very much converging because the tobacco movement is driven, in trying to sort of achieve something in China, is very much pushing the idea that there are real costs to China's healthcare problems, that that the Chinese need to be thinking in the long term about the burden that's being placed on the healthcare system from tobacco, also from the environment. The tobacco movement has maybe to its advantage a global treaty, the first global public health treaty, the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, which China signed in 2003, ratified in 2005, and began implementing in 2006, has 8 ministries on the implementation committee led by the NDRC, and they are committed by this international treaty to do something about tobacco. And so they're being forced to really get serious about this throughout the system from the center all the way down to the provinces. As they push this agenda, though, it's basically helping to make, I think, everybody in China more conscious about the right to health. I mean, it's the right to not be exposed to smoke in an indoor environment where, your air outside in China is horrible, but the air inside a smoky environment is hundreds of times worse. So it's this idea that people have a right not to be exposed to smoke, but actually to be exposed, to have a right to clean air everywhere, to a healthy environment. So the movements are very much, I see them very much converging, and I see the tobacco movement has this treaty behind it, which is helping to push things forward. But the environmental movement, I think, is being pulled along with it. Certainly in the work that I'm doing, I'm seeing we do a lot of cooperation with the environmental groups. And I think that I just wanted to kind of throw that out there and suggest that maybe that needs to be part of the bigger picture.
No, I think that's a fair point. I mean, I will say it's yeah, in looking at the tobacco issue, I mean, it has less of the cross-cutting, the inter-bureaucratic turf squabbles than significantly fewer because of the NDRC is less focused on tobacco as an engine of growth than they are an engine of growth that leads to environmental challenges. So, I agree with you 100% that the issues are related, but I think they're first of all, there is less. Even though the issue of tobacco continues to rise as a significant challenge in China, there is more consensus that tobacco is a problem at the top than there is on the environmental and the environmental issues. So I think more attention needs to be paid. Yeah. Right. Chris had.
Thanks, Charles. Yeah, I kidnapped the mic. Chris Nelson, Nelson Report. I've participated in the last couple of years with increasing numbers of conferences, some closed, some not, on quotes energy and the environment and China. Now, a great deal of them are, in a sense, more strategic, almost DOD-focused, looking at oil supply and routes and all that. But one of the major things that really impressed me right from the start is when you're sitting around a table with a bunch of men and women with stars on their shoulders, and they're not talking about, you know, blockading China to save oil for America. They're talking about cooperating with China. You know, you get Navy guys talking about how we cooperate, which leads me to my question. You know, when you spend as much time as we all do watching Congress and listening to them, you know that generally speaking, when they look at China or hear about China, for most of them, it's because some bit of bad news has been brought to their attention. You know, a lead toy is eaten by one of their constituents, or, you know, they just saw the latest air pollution statistics, or, you know, whatever the latest trade horror is. You know, they almost never hear about cooperative efforts, and there's very little knowledge, I think, generally on what we're doing together, what joint things we're doing. Probably you guys know a great deal more about that than most of us, and particularly on energy technology, capacity building. You know, the Japanese were trying to get everybody to think about that kind of stuff last week. What can you tell us about U.S.-China cooperation, organized programs, government to government or NGOs or whatever, that would be talking points the next time, you know, your hometown Congress is, oh, those damn Chinese, they're firing ICBMs at us every week in the form of bad air and bad water. And, you know, there's got to be yeah, but responses. Thanks.
I don't know the raw numbers, but there are almost every agency that's out there, DOE, DOC, state, and certainly under the SED, there are specific issues related to energy and environmental cooperation. One of the big challenges, and this is where Congress comes into play, one of the big challenges with giving some teeth behind some of these is they tend to be unfunded at the end of the day. And so it's very difficult for DOC or DOE to come to the table and say to the Chinese, here's what we're actually going to do for you, because they can't get it. They can't get any meat on those bones. So there's a lot more that can be done. That said, it's very tough, and this is where you and I will as well as I do, it's very tough for someone sitting in Congress to listen to a constituent say, wait a minute, you're going to tax us in order to reduce our environmental emissions, and you're talking about paying the Chinese to reduce theirs? I mean, that's a tough sell. They're not completely irrational on Capitol Hill.
Let me add maybe just a couple small points to that, Chris. The first is that I think in terms of messaging to constituents and to congressmen, where I get the biggest surprises is about leadership intentions. Right? It's very surprising to people that China is not trying to become the world's largest steel producer, that they're concerned about growth in industries that there's competitive pressures on here in the U.S. You know, there's all the questions about does that implement at a local level, but it's very surprising to learn that there's not five guys in a room in Beijing clicking their fingers together trying to figure out how to take over the U.S.
Seven
guys. that there's, and this is what, as you would know, Codell's first time to China, this is what they come back with, is, man, I'm glad I don't have that job, trying to keep that train on the tracks, right? And I think that's a message that can't be reinforced enough, that these are Herculean challenges China's dealing with, and they're doing the best they can. On a narrow element of cooperation that maybe your readers will know about or care about, though maybe not this room, we don't have global notwithstanding language on energy and environment, right? Which means that the sanctions put in place in China in the wake of Tiananmen Square preclude the State Department from spending any money in China on energy and environment. DOE, Commerce have slightly different constraints, but State is constrained. There is baskets of money inside State that could be, without additional appropriation, could be spent on energy and environment initiatives in China, but aren't because we haven't passed global notwithstanding language. I think that's something that would be easy enough to do in this political climate and would have a pretty real impact.
My name is Ahmed Mir. I used to be in the Foreign Service. I was 5 years in Mexico during the NAFTA negotiations, and environment was a really critical part. I'm glad that you have taken this subject, but it's very big. I mean, it's massive. I don't think I would be optimistic in the short run on China tackling its environmental problems. It is embedded in the whole structure of systems. But I think one of the things that I'm glad that you recommended is cooperation with the U.S. Mexico was the first place where we got an EPA attaché, and actually congressional visits and so on. And Mexican health is American health. And environment is synonymous with health. Why are we worried about environment? The only reason is because it affects man. So it's really synonymous with health. Just want to say that the Mexico example would be interesting. In 5 years, we saw progress, but nothing of the scale that we wanted. We gave tremendous support all the way from waste management to, you know, pollution in industries. Mexico decided that the most important thing was enforcement, and they created essentially an attorney general to prosecute violations of the environmental laws. And I think penalty is probably much more important at this initial stage. I think every institution in China is likely to be essentially a major cause of environmental problems. I mean, it's not the big steel plants. It'll be across the country. And I think I'm glad you have raised it, and I would like the U.S. Government and State Department to actually promote this, because we have tremendous possibilities of giving intellectual help. I think we want to build up Chinese leaders in the environmental area, so they themselves will, you know, demand this. And I think transparency is important, because that's what will create the feedback and correction. I don't think we can do it from outside, but it's a very big problem. Thank you.
Yeah, our hands are not exactly clean with respect to the environment, so I think it's a useful thing for the United States to get together with China, and the two biggest polluters can, if we can start to tackle this, no matter how big an issue, I think it's a useful start. Over here, yeah.
Yeah, my name is Anna Bertel. I'm a research associate at the University of Maryland. I also work at the National Endowment for Democracy. We know that some of the statistics that are collected on pollution streams, that they don't include all industries or all enterprises. It only includes the data in these data collection zones. And so I'm wondering if there's some percent of that, as enterprises are moving west, that these data collection zones or more enterprises are not being included in some of these statistics. And I'm just wondering to get your feedback on that. And also wondering, this is in connection with, you know, we saw a decrease in sulfur dioxide emissions for the first time last year. So I'm wondering what do you see is leading to that result? And what percent perhaps is due to enterprises moving west?
I don't know what's in or out of the data zones. I don't know that anybody knows. I don't know if you guys know. And it's possible that the numbers of SO2 reductions are an artifact. The point that I would make is that it's very plausible for very little cost that the sulfur scrubbers that were installed, and I've talked to power companies, and it makes sense on economic terms for them to install the scrubbers now, given incentives. And, you know, they run a slight deficit in terms of coal if they turn them on, maybe it's, depending on the scrubber, between 5 and 8%. So that's an economic penalty in operating them. But it's not a Herculean effort to reduce SO2 emissions from power plants. I mean, that's the point that I would make. I think that, sure, the enforcement and monitoring, it has holes and it's going to need to get better. But compared to water problems, compared to CO2 problems, sulfur's not as big of a challenge, I think, in tackling.
Just in terms of the go west, the movement of from the coast to the center, I'm not sure that there's been a significant enough movement yet that you can actually identify changes that would have resulted. Even if you look at close downs of factories in Guangdong recently, that the 10,000 or so that have shut down, a lot of those are just shuttered. They're not being moved inland. They're closed. End of story. So I'm not sure that there's been a dramatic movement. You can say, okay, well, as a result of close down here, then it's being moved over here and not being captured in terms of monitoring. I don't think we have the data one way or the other.
Yaqing Song from Tsinghua University, Beijing. And I'm very interested in this three-element analysis framework, central-local relationship, inter-provincial, and state-society. And actually, this framework can be used to analyze all the governance issues in China. So my question is, in terms of relationship between environmental governance and the general governance, I think there are two possibilities. One is environmental governance can be a breakthrough of the whole governance issue. That means civil society or decentralization can really play a great role in environmental protection. But there is also another possibility that environmental governance will finally be restricted by the current political framework and governmental defeats. So my question is, which possibility do you think is more possible on this issue? This question matters because that will influence your final policy recommendation.
I'm trying to be more optimistic. I think environment sphere has good precedence in the past in terms of working with the international non-governmental organizations and international communities to set up good precedents to have green groups in China and have the input from the civil society. So I hope that this whole environmental governance could be a good first step for the whole China's overall governance problem. Charles?
I believe that the Hu Jintao government is sincere in the effort, and so I'm optimistic. But I mean, the challenges, as Trevor said, particularly in the environmental sphere, are enormous. I mean, the obstacles are tremendous. And our policymakers should be nervous, should be glad that they don't have these challenges. I mean, they're significant.
Scott Harold from Brookings. First, Xiaoqing and Charles, congratulations. This is another fabulous product from you guys' shop, and it really looks fascinating. Could either of you address the extent to which you see environmental pollution and or health serving as a long-term barrier to continued Chinese growth? For example, Carnegie recently released its report by Bert Keitel saying that looking out to 2035, 2050, he does not anticipate environmental problems posing a severe obstacle, an insurmountable obstacle to China's continued rapid growth. Could you comment on that? In particular, you've identified a number of sources of optimism, and certainly leadership change over the last 5 years. Certainly some of the major crises that we've seen, you mentioned Songhua benzene spill. These are opportunities, and current research on China's environmental policies have revealed that these are the moments when and real significant inputs for policy change. Do you see anything like that happening in the future as the second part of this question?
I'm not too concerned about the growth. I think my concern is more on the social stability. I think that China will continue to grow, maybe at a slower pace, but I think the impact on social stability is something that keeps the vision leadership awake at night. And Charles, do you have any?
Yeah. I mean, this is not going to cost nothing to actually deal with the issue. So if you posit that environmental regulation is actually going to be a drag on the economy, there are some signs, and Trevor, I think, identified some. In some cases, getting rid of 13 million jobs in energy-intensive sectors is not a huge drag in the economy. But putting scrubbers and doing all the rest of things with the lower-level industries, that's a potential drag in the economy. What impact does that have on your annual growth rate? Who knows? And the reality is that you've still got 300, 400 million people that you're trying to pull out of the rural areas and put into urban areas. That's a whole lot more steel. That's a whole lot more concrete. That's a whole lot more other stuff that you need to produce. So you've got this mandate for growth, which is going to keep up, at the same time as this mandate for environment. The two conflict inherently, and that does lead to social stability. Social stability is its own drag on growth. So um, I, 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 My own sense is that, yeah, this is going to lead to a head at some point, and there are optimists out there, T. Boone Pickens out there, that say, well, there's a big wind farm that, you know, that's going to create lots of jobs and everything's going to be great. But I'm not convinced.
Let me posit three scenarios for you and kind of address this maybe from a different standpoint. I think there's a couple of different outcomes we could expect. One is that we continue on business as usual, right? And there the challenge isn't so much it's in the cost of the environmental degradation. It's in the structure of the economy that's giving rise to that, which is unsustainable, which will turn into immiserating growth at some point. Investment rates this high, trade surplus this high is unsustainable, and that's what's driving a lot of this challenge. Even if that's if that's rebalanced, if we see a change in the structure of growth and a movement away from polluting industries towards services, that's going to create some economic upside. That's going to buy you out of some of your air pollution problems, but it's still going to leave a fairly large remediation expense when it comes to water pollution. That's not going to go away. There's just water availability issues that are going to be very expensive to deal with. I think if you have a successful change in macroeconomic policy for a more sustainable underlying trajectory, then the fiscal resources, economic resources will be there so that you can deal with those remediation issues in a way that doesn't tank growth. I think if you don't deal with the underlying structural cause of the current problem, you're going to have constrained fiscal resources and even larger remediation problems, and that's where I think you get into your kind of crisis scenario.
Shaw from Chinese Embassy.
Hi. Congratulations on the wonderful report. Maybe I just want to point out one intentionally printing mistake or error. In your recommendation, you talk about the SED. Instead of saying this strategic economic dialogue, you use the U.S.-China strategic dialogue. Maybe you think it important to call it a strategic dialogue. My question is that since you believe that the SED is so important and so strategic, and I wish to know to what extent should the dialogue focus on the environment and the healthy issues? And you also talk about the lack of international cooperation between China and other countries in this field. And how would you look at why is the lack of the international cooperation? Is it because China, or is it because the United States unwilling to provide like funding or technology, or who is more to blame?
Thank you for the comment on the. Usually we send this over to you and you correct it, but in this case we were unable to. I will say, the environment and health issues should be a big focus of the United States and China. A, because it's an opportunity for us to cooperate, and that's finding sources and areas for the United States and China to cooperate is a key function. I mean, we have plenty of areas of friction that we will have in security, in economics, and in normative areas for the next 10, 15, 20, 30 years. So finding areas of cooperation, and particularly in areas where the United States and China can collectively have a genuinely beneficial impact on the rest of the world, I mean, that's a very important place to start. So not to be Pollyanna-ish about this, but focusing on environmental health is very important. Whose fault is it that there hasn't been more cooperation, or whose fault is it? I think, frankly, there hasn't been the attention paid to the fact that the reason that we care about the environment is health issues. And as Xiaoqing said at the beginning, one of the things that we found in looking at this issue is there really hasn't been a lot of development of the sense of what the connection is between health problems in China and the environmental problems. It's not a unique thing in China. I mean, there hasn't been, if you look at health and environmental problems in other parts of the world, whether it's Tokyo before the Tokyo Olympics or in Seoul before the Tokyo, there are similar sort of challenges that came out without the analysis of what the nexus was, what the connection was. So it's not necessarily a complete saying this is China's fault or this is anybody's fault, but that doesn't mean that the problem doesn't need correction, and that the issue does not need attention. Does that require the United States to pay more attention, perhaps pay some money? Yes, it does. But it also requires that China recognize that that it perhaps could use some help in this area. A win-win. Last question. Right here.
I'm thinking of when China decided to join the WTO. I do think the WTO joining it had a great beneficial effect on the Chinese economy, because those sloppy, inefficient industries, the state-owned industries, had to, you know, thin down and become more efficient. And I think a more, a tighter international environmental framework might have the same effect. And the U.S. could perhaps agree to such a thing, even though it's not been generally in the past what the U.S. wants to do. What do you think of that?
How much time do you have? At the end of the day, very simply, one of the things that I think we've learned from China's rise, even over the last 5 years, is that our global architecture, created in the wake of the Second World War, didn't contemplate that you'd have one of the world's largest developing economies be such a major factor in global resource consumption and global production. So perhaps the architecture of the UN, the IMF, the WTO, and the rest of the of that architecture is inadequate to deal not just with the rise of China, but with the current challenges that we face. So perhaps we do need to re-examine our approach to global institutions with China at the table. Thanks, everybody, for coming. Really appreciate it.